Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
For $5 a month, you can actually see the Thin Green Line interviews and other video content on Patreon.com. Just search the Thin Green Line podcast on Patreon.com. That's Patreon.com, and feel like you're part of the conversation. Join us. So John and I are just sitting down to do a Thin Green Line podcast, but we kind of wanted to give everybody an update on what we've been doing this spring and what we're continuing to do. I've been traveling the East Coast. John's always traveling the West Coast. He's, you know, cut up with some really cool new sponsors that we're excited to introduce to our listenership. John, why don't you start off, man? I mean, you've been rocking and rolling, and literally, actually. So when we talk about rocking and rolling, we can't forget your band either, man.
Wayne, man, it's been a dynamic 2024 for us both. It's been good to see. I'm very excited about all the guests we've had early on in the year. We're about to record an episode here shortly after our conversation right now with you and I, with the awesome Kevin Estella from Fieldcraft Survival North Carolina. I was just on his show that dropped yesterday. And man, talk about a prepared, like-mindedness conservationist that we're going to get into a little bit later today. But yeah, man, it's been a good spring. I mean, as you know, had the privilege of being invited to testify in the U.S. Congress last October, ironically on border control, but more specifically how it related to environmental crimes, impacts to our national parks, and had some testimony for the first time. And, you know, you and I speak at a lot of events, but I can tell you that this was probably the most stressful to prepare for, because it was the U.S. Congress.
Yeah, let's face it, that's the ultimate testifying, if you ask me. And what an honor, John, what an honor.
Yeah, no, thanks, brother. It was. And what we learned in D.C. by doing that testimony is we kind of catalyzed some awareness that went beyond the border, went way into conservation, went way into Thin Green Line topics. So I was really, really honored and happy with that. And now we're starting to see a lot more congressional and Senate groups, you know, looking at the Chinese and the Mexican cartel connection that, ironically, we had Bill Bodner on recently, our second-time guest, retired DEA SAC out of Los Angeles, that you and I had a great conversation with. So that was just awesome. And now, as a result of that and other podcasts, I'll be in Pennsylvania, Michigan, Oregon, California, multiple states in April, basically training teams, talking to security experts, Pennsylvania Game Fish Commission, you know, wardens and non-sworn, everybody on what you and I are about, basically. What's the environmental impacts? What are these threats? What do game wardens have to look at beyond the norm now in this new world? So it's going to be a busy April.
Yeah, 100%. Everything you've been talking about is coming to fruition. I hate to say that. You know, we're starting to see the Chinese in Maine, of all places, and these remote areas that, you know, we all operate in, you know, as game wardens, as park rangers. We're starting to see the effects that you've been talking about for the last 5 years down on the border coming, and now they're coming to a piece of woods near us. And it's kind of scary to see that with that fruition, that progression. And even more so, you know, you got to tell this story, and it's becoming more and more relevant every time we do a podcast, just the news and stuff. And I'm like, man, John talked about that like 4 years ago. And here we are, especially with Bill, when we sat down with Bill Bodner and, you know, sat down and had our first discussion, and to watch this increase and to see this and, you know, everything that's going on.
Yeah, it's been unfortunate, brother, but the one thing I do like is with awareness comes preparedness, and with awareness comes confidence, and, you know, you go from fear to awareness, and the awareness leads to that preparedness. And like we're going to talk about with Kevin Estella shortly, preparedness and readiness is really what we need to look at as a nation. And we don't want to live in paranoid fear. We don't want to not enjoy our woods.
Right.
But I think knowing what's going on out there, Wayne, and knowing how we can take that back by not staying away from those areas we love and making sure we find those problems and stop them or get people that can, And we have to do it as a unified front. And I think what's really cool when I look at the congressional groups now is bipartisan, regardless of how much divisiveness is going on between the left in Congress and in the Senate. One thing they're all fired up about is just like the whole, you know, hidden war issue.
Yes.
Nobody likes dead wildlife. Nobody likes poisons in our water. Nobody likes threats in our woods and in our communities. And because this cartel thing has gotten so pervasive in the cities, which human trafficking, sex trafficking, the fentanyl issue, methamphetamine, it affects everybody. So now we as a country can say, hey, we're not going to take this. Our lawmakers need to make a change. And regardless of what they change or not right away, we're going to stay safe because we're aware now. And we've done that a lot with the podcast and had a lot of really good feedback. And I'm grateful for the opportunity that we have, you and I, on these platforms to get fellow thin greenliners aware.
Yeah.
And I think that's the key to what we're doing. And we're grateful to all you listeners and viewers out there for spreading the word, tuning in. And we can't thank you guys enough because we just can't spread the word enough and get people aware and more importantly, safe without the help of our listeners. So grateful to everybody that tunes into both of our platforms.
No, it's been good to get this information out for sure. I mean, most game wardens, park rangers, forest rangers, where they're aware, they get that sixth sense that accrues. But to put that on their front plate and put that in front of them, I think is really important because it just gives you that extra edge. Knowledge is power, let's face it.
Yeah,
for sure.
And something else that's kind of developed is we've got a couple of new really cool sponsors. Shows. Obviously, we had Karen Hunter on recently on our Thin Green Line podcast, and she's a marketing director and kind of quite an outreach go-getter for Securit Safes, gun storage boxes. And they've become very, very committed to the Thin Green Line, very committed to wildlife conservation. And now we're sponsoring you and I on both platforms,
right?
And putting our word out and spreading the word of the podcast. So that's been exciting. And we just recently picked up another sponsor, XS Sights, which make fantastic rifle, pistol, and shotgun sights.
Yeah.
And Jeff King over there, who was previously with Triumph Systems, and did a lot of work with him with Jared's team. And we had Jared Ogden on our podcast quite a while ago, our SEAL Team 1 veteran,
yeah.
Triumph Systems CEO. It was fun. And now they're all about spreading the Thin Green Line word, and that's all happened within the last month. So that's been exciting for the podcast and also exciting, I think, for our platform in general, because they're going to be networking what we stand for and going not just from the tactical preparedness side, but over to the conservation side and the Thin Green Line side and environmental protection. And man, the more Thin Green Liners we get, the better off we are. It's pretty exciting on that front.
Yeah, for sure. And spreading the word, you know, that we wear so many hats in this, but all for conservation. And you know, my new position as executive director for International Wildlife Crime Stoppers has taken me down to the Great American Outdoors Show to interact with there, working with our strategic partner, GuideFitter, down there, which has been really good. We're working on some new and exciting stuff for next year. Then they sent me down to the National Wild Turkey Conference down there in Nashville. And again, making those contacts with fellow conservation groups for sure. NWTF does such an awesome job nationwide on conserving, you know, our not even our turkeys, but everything. Because when you work on one species, you benefit it all. So it's been a really good, great thing working with you know, those types of people, as well as rubbing shoulders with the men and women of conservation law enforcement nationwide. So. Certainly, it's been a cool thing for me to do. And along the way, I'm podcasting, too. I'm breaking out the recorder, sitting down with officers, doing some warden's watches, making connections just like you do, John. And yeah, it's been fun. But as you know, it's tiring, too. You get a little worn out.
Yeah. And you've been running hot, brother. You've been running hot. The thing with those shows that I like is the networking, is the ability to get, and like you said, Wild Turkey and IWC, fantastic organizations that can perpetuate our message.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of travel involved, and we don't get the opportunity to get face-to-face with our podcast guests.
Right.
Because we are so remote, and we are across the country from each other. And when we can sit down at, when we can all, you know, find a center place where we're at some event and go, okay, let's get face-to-face and do these till we're blue in the face and we collapse. Let's get as many in person, because we just love the in-person, you know?
Yeah.
The studio connections are really good, and that's been really great. What you've been able to pull off, especially the first part of this year, as we launch into a dynamic 2024 with those organizations helping us out. And good job there. That's awesome. Mm.
Yeah. And just remind everybody, within the Warden's Watch podcast group, we had the Thin Green Line lives in there. We started Warden News, which I'm looking for help. Hunting season was really easy to get stories. I will tell you, fishing season's becoming a little more struggle. I have had some press releases sent to me from some other agencies, but we're putting out the Warden's News with our producer, Jay Scott's helping me out with that. Again, just it's a quick thing. What's going on nationwide, internationally, in the conservation law segment. It's just it's kind of quick, easy, and informative. So we have all those three podcasts living within the Warden's Watch kind of thing. So just so everybody knows it, you go to Warden's Watch, but you get much, much more under those. So yeah, and I think it's worked out very well. I think people are liking that platform. Someday we may break out the Thin Green Line again. Who knows? We may yeah. go back out on its own. But for now, this is where everything's living. So the Warden's Watch podcast, if you go to there and search it, and hit that follow button. You know, I sound like every other podcaster now. It's just strange, but hit that follow button. It helps for sure.
It really does, and if you guys can give us that 5-star rating on Apple, that certainly helps the algorithm of driving people to our platform and wings as we have combined under the Warden's Watch umbrella. It's been a one-stop shop. You know, I've had a lot of listeners and viewers go, hey, now I can go to that website and I can find Thin Green Line in the library lineup of Warden's Watch. And what's happened is some of our Thin Green Liners that signed up to watch that when we started that podcast weren't really paying attention to Warden's Watch. And they're going, oh, I started listening to episodes that were in the scroll. And it's been really good.
I saw
you and Wayne doing your thing a year ago, and then you know when you interviewed CJ Box, and when you brought in Chief Nancy Foley, blah blah blah. So that the combination has been really good.
Yeah.
But we definitely can always use the help with the support from the standpoint of good ratings and following us as we continue to grow and bring you more content because we're able to but with that support.
Absolutely. I parked my truck, and everybody knows my truck is wrapped to Warden's Watch podcast the other day. And a guy said, hey, what's that all about? I said, well, I do a podcast about game wardens. And he goes, oh, I read all the CJ Box stories and all the books. And I said, well, we interviewed him twice. And he's like, oh, my God, are you kidding me? I'm like, no. So
no, he's a friend of the show.
He's a friend of the show. Yeah. Too funny. So yeah, looking forward to another really cool year as we move and shake. And, you know, you can always send out those requests if there's something you specifically want. You know, my goal for Warden's Watch is to hit every state. That's I shouldn't say it's difficult, but I have so much content out of some other states that's so good that, you know, I am basically booked out with Warden's Watch for probably a year ahead of time, if you can have that. And that's a good problem to have. For sure.
It really is. It really is. And I know, you know, from my alma mater in California, we have retired med officers that had stellar traditional careers, and we've got them ready to go.
Yeah.
They can be on now that they're retired, and we'll make that happen. But something else that's ramping up, and, you know, when we're through the winter months and grinding on the outreach work that I forget about, is what's happening with Area 56 with our Rock Band in Montana.
So much fun.
You and I talked a little bit about that before the show, but Wayne, we have what's called woodshed season that goes from about January up until we start our gig season, which starts in the early summer. That's where we just get in the studio and we just work on new music that we haven't done before, completely from scratch. And you know how that goes. You're spending hours because you don't know stuff. It's new challenges. And then we have older songs, classic rock songs. And this year is our most challenging year yet. We've added 8 new songs to the lineup. I won't say what they are yet. They're not easy. So we're spending a lot of time frustrating ourselves in my studio to get those ready for performance. And our first performance won't start until June. And then we have 8 gigs throughout the summer, right up till New Year's at the end of the year. It's one of our biggest gig years with our biggest number of followers. So we're really trying to diversify and, you know, kind of intensify our challenges. And this will be our best set year as far as music goes that we've ever done. But that's another involved job like what you and I are doing right here. You can't do a podcast, you know, half-ass and not be prepared. And when you're playing music live in front of a lot of listeners, you can imagine how that goes. So we're having a good time with it. And certainly I will be putting more stuff up on social media. You guys can follow Area 56 on our Facebook page. I do put stuff up on my personal Instagram and, of course, my YouTube channel. and we'll be putting more music videos up at people's requests. But it's been a fun process, and you know, do kind of a mountain band in Montana brings again the conservation, the love of the outdoors, because we play a lot of beautiful venues in one of the most remote parts of the country, and it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, for sure. And it's so good to have something outside of your norm to do. It's almost refreshing when you do something. When I work with the canines and the dogs and the 4-H, it's just, it breaks you up. So you're not always focused on, you know, you get that mindset, conservation. You put those blinders on, and it's good to break out of those and talk to other people and get a feel what's going on in other venues and genres. And yeah, being multi-talented, John, that's pretty awesome. I always enjoy your gigs and the little clips you put out and the fun you're having doing it. That's, you know, that's the most important thing, I think. And I enjoy it too.
Yeah, more than anything, we got to keep what we do fun.
Yes.
You know, life is too short. You know, there's a lot of darker subjects that we have to deal with. And, you know, we address that on the shows. And, you know, a big part of my outreach world is not a pretty picture. It's a direct health threat. It's really intense stuff that we got to look at as a national priority. And I'm out there politicking to make it more of a national priority and bring more awareness to it all around. Really, not only public safety, but the love for our resources, our wildland, waterways, and wildlife. And that can get pretty pessimistic at times. And when we can rock out and bring communities together and celebrate music in person, obviously, we had the COVID lockdowns and our band didn't gig for an entire year. And all we did was woodshed together when we could. And, you know, our friends from Shinedown, we had Barry on the show, talking to Eric and Zach and Brent backstage at shows when they were apart for a year. I mean, you know, you're missing your best friends, you're missing your family, and then the public are missing their music, which always is an elixir. It's always, you know, exudes a little bit of hope and joy when depression and everything was kicking in through that hard time. So you're right, man, we got to have fun, rather than hunting, hiking, fishing, you know, watching your awesome son crush it on the hockey field, man.
For sure.
Super inspirational to see, because he's just, Andrew's just crushing it. Really enjoying seeing
him. He's had a good senior year.
One for the books, man. One for the ages.
100%. And he said, you know, the parade was very impressive to him. So when they rolled into town, the fire trucks, the police, the, you know, get all in front of him, and they run a parade up through to the high school. And he was like, yeah, that's when it hit Dad, you know, when all of a sudden he's like,
I've done something.
But we're starting to pick up cruisers along the way. way before they get to their town, they're picking up, you know, state police, and they're rolling them in. And as they're getting closer, they're picking up fire trucks. And he's like, oh, this is really serious. Is it like, he's like, yeah, that and there, the kids are hanging outside the bus. And yeah, it was a really good, you know, to have a championship hockey title for your senior year and be part of a team. So that's really cool.
Yeah, I mean, that's a lifetime memory, man.
Yeah.
And, you know, to do it this early, that sets the stage of some aspirations he might have in that and other areas. And, you know, and you guys got to be so proud. I'm super proud of him. I've been trying to show him that support on your posts and definitely keep conveying to him, man, we're all very proud of what he's doing, because he's really exemplifying what young men and women stand for, you know, in America.
I think I'm going to have you write a letter for his scholarships too, because that was good.
Yeah. I need the soundbite. So
was really good. So that's exactly what he's doing, scholarships now. And
well, let's get him going. I'll do anything I can.
I don't know if I shared this with you, but he's going to go to my alma mater, the State University of New York, Cobleskill, for dog training. So he's going to train, whether it's conservation canines, police canines, detection dogs. That's what he wants to do. He wants to, you know, give us our best friends, our best partners, and all trained up and ready to rock and roll. So I think it's a unique thing that he's doing, and I'm pretty excited for him.
That is super, super, super awesome. And tell him congrats, and yeah, definitely get him a letter. Whatever I can do to help, I'd be happy to.
Always appreciated, John. And that's what we're going to be doing this year. So maybe we'll give you an update along the go. But because it's always changing. We're always moving. We're always shaking. We're always trying to have fun. And we're always trying to do podcasts along the way and bring in some of the people that we network with. So, and that's what we're going to be doing.
I love it. Yeah, more to follow, guys. And again, everybody tuning in, we are very grateful. You are the Thin Green Line. You make this possible. Mm-hmm. Wayne and I can't do it without you. 100%. And just please keep spreading the word, and we're going to keep grinding to bring you more diverse content and definitely the latest and greatest updates, hence having this conversation, Wayne, that honestly we've been talking about. We just well overdue. So getting a catch up between the two of us and where we're at and what we want to do with the shows for you guys. So thank you all. And yeah, Wayne, we got another cool guest this morning. So
yeah,
I'm about on it.
Looking forward to another Thin Green Line podcast.
We are very honored and excited to have a friend of ours, Kevin Estella, Director of Survival for Fieldcraft Survival in the North Carolina facility. Man, Kevin is doing a lot of stuff. He's written the best-selling book, 101 Skills You Need to Survive in the Woods. Been teaching bushcraft and survival skills professionally since 2007. Comes from an actual high school academic instructor background that we're going to talk about before he got into the survival aspect of things. And near and dear to all of us on the Thin Green Line podcast, he's an avid outdoorsman, a conservationist, an angler, a fisherman, a backpacker, living the woods. The woods are his church as well. And I just had the opportunity to do his podcast a week or so ago. We had a fantastic conversation, finally connecting. And what an honor to have you on today, Kevin. How the heck are you? Where are you at today, man? You're all over the board.
Yeah, you know, one thing that I can say is that I feel like I'm more of a tramp. I feel like I'm a vagabond. I'm someone who's like a gypsy. I don't ever really get a chance to kind of create roots. But right now I'm recording this from the powder room in Panama City, Florida. I was brought down as a guest of a former student who's taken a survival class and a land nav class with me. And he's like, you've got to see my gun range and my training center. He wants to eventually host courses here for Fieldcraft. Nice. He wants to expand what they're doing here. I mean, I was just in a meeting with the vice president of the larger holding group, and he was telling me how they've donated thousands and thousands. I mean, we're talking millions of dollars worth of land for long-term conservation, land trust. Wow. So there will never be development on some of the largest water features here. On East Coast time and I'm currently in Central time, you know, I've just been running around. And for those listening, if you don't understand the comedy of that, like I try to be very particular about staying on time with courses, and I'm a taskmaster. So when I'm just wrapping up this meeting with this high-end executive guy here at the St. Joe company, I get a message from the podcasters here and they're like, we're in the Zoom meeting. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I feel like a total jerk. So I'm coming to you guys from Panama City, Florida, from the powder room. And I have to say they are carrying the Thin Green Line knife.
Wow.
At the powder room. So it actually works out perfectly that I'm in a good spot to do this podcast with people who are supportive of everything you guys do.
Wow, this is awesome, man. Well, thanks for coming on the show, for one. I know you have been hopping around. We talked about when we were recording your show not too long ago that you were headed to Florida to look at a new site. That's very exciting, and it looks like this may be the spot where you can expand the Fieldcraft curriculum, which has been so popular, especially on your side of survival readiness and how that's really escalated in the last couple of years, which we're going to dive into the show. So kudos to that, and hope everything's going to work out really well in Florida. It sounds like a great place, and they are all about conservation with what they're preserving out there. Good stuff.
Yeah, for sure. Very interesting in Florida, North Carolina. You grew up, I think, in my backyard, Kevin, in the White Mountains of New Hampshire. And when I start thinking Florida, I think snakes and stuff like that. And these northern boys, where we got lots of snow, we just don't deal well with snakes. And I still, even as a game warden, and I know many game wardens in the north don't deal well with snakes. But when you talk about Fieldcraft survival in Florida, that's the first thing that jumps to my mind.
Oh my gosh. I grew up in Connecticut and I spent a lot of time up in the White Mountains. I went through Eastern Mountain Sports Climbing School. So I did winter mountaineering on Mount Washington.
Very cool.
I've spent a lot of time in Tuckerman Ravine. I love the Whites. It will always be a second home just because, nice. As you said, I'm a northern boy. Like I cut my teeth in the boreal forest in that thick, dense, old growth forest of upstate New York, and in Connecticut. I grew up along the Farmington River, fishing there for, you know, brook trout or brown trout, rainbow trout. So yeah, when I come to Florida, it is interesting. My girlfriend lives down in this area in Florida. And yeah, they have, not only do they have the brown recluse, they have the black widow, they have all these different types of tropical snakes that can survive down here. Oh, and let's not forget that they have modern day roaming dinosaurs called alligators. If there's a body of water in Florida, there is a good chance there is a gator in it. And it's like, you don't experience that in up in New England. Like, we don't have to worry about gators. We have to worry about snapping turtles, but not gators.
Yeah, for sure. It's a whole different world. And, you know, reading your bio and stuff and working in Africa and stuff, that's always, every time I'm like, creepy crawlies and the spiders never faze me. I don't know why, the snakes, it's the surprise more than anything. And just because, you're right, we don't have to deal with it. And do we ever, it's very, very rare that we deal with snakes in northern New Hampshire. And you talk about Tuckermans, oh my goodness. I, you know, as a game warden, I did so many search and rescue missions in that area just because of the types of people that visit it. Whether I was a grunt conservation officer, game warden, to right up to the lieutenant running search and rescue missions off of Mount Washington, you know, one of probably the most popular spots to go hiking in New England for sure. The nice thing is we have a train that goes to the top. We have a road that goes to a top. So that's good things for a search and rescue manager to have. But, and people don't take it very seriously because they're only 6,000 footers. And I hear this all the time. And I keep telling people, if you go out west, what level does the tree not grow at? And they're like, oh, probably starts around 10,000. I said, and what area in New England does it stop growing at in the White Mountains? And they're like, oh, I never thought about that. I said, yeah, that's like 4,000 feet. So the same weather you're encountering out there at 10,000 feet, you're encountering at 4,000 feet here in New England. So take it seriously. And I'm sure that's one thing you got to preach in your genre.
Yeah, I mean, when I went with the Eastern Mountain Sports Climbing School to do my first winter summit of Mount Washington, I watched one of the climbing school guides turn back a tourist who had a pair of like boat shoes with white socks and a water bottle attached to the outside of his backpack. This guy made it all the way up to Lion's Head right before there's that notch on the winter route.
Yep.
And where you turn around and now suddenly you're above tree line. He made it all the way up there. And the guide was like, you need to turn around. He's like, if you do not turn around, we are coming after your body. We will recover your body. We will not rescue you. Mm-hmm. And the guy, like, he finally put two and two together. Like, he was grabbing his jacket. Like, you don't have this. You don't have, like, people underestimate the mountains. And there's a great book called Not Without Peril, which explains all the different fatalities that have happened on the White Mountains, where someone is walking by like Amonoosuc Brook, you know, and they happen to fall into the brook, and their body's not recovered until after spring because they're like, oh, it's just a creek. Well, that creek is rushing and you're not going to be able to poke your head out of the ice when you get swallowed underneath it. And as you mentioned, the tree line out there, it's low. And there's a theory that Mount Washington at one point was actually higher than Mount Everest. But because of the convergence of all the weather patterns, that wind erosion knocked it down for millions and millions of years. So people underestimate it. As you said, it's not even that high. Look, we're going right there. But every single year you hear about people who make mistakes. They underestimate Mother Nature, who has a winning record. Like, Mother Nature will kill you. They underestimate her, and then they get into trouble. And unfortunately, that puts good people like you and other game wardens and other search and rescue people in harm's way, which it's unfair to them, you know? So I get it. If you need like an actual rescue team to come after you for something that was out of your hands,
100%.
By all means, it's a legitimate rescue.
Yeah.
But I also love the fact that if you do cause a rescue because you're ill-prepared, they'll make you pay for it.
Right.
Like if the helicopter comes in, you're paying for that bird to come in and pull you off the mountain.
Yeah. I got a funny story about that. I had a professor from a Boston University that he was reported lost a winter hike, and he ended up at the Mount Washington Hotel. And for those that don't know, this is a very elaborate hotel that's been around probably for 100 years, but it is top notch. Well, he got in and he took a room and he messaged his wife, but he wasn't signed on to the system, so the message never went anywhere. So when I found out after we deployed a National Guard helicopter at $2,500 an hour, search and rescue people, and I found out he was there, I went down and he was having coffee in the lobby, very elaborate little coffee, and I sat down to him and we started having a discussion, and I told him we were looking for him and things like that. And then he showed me, actually, so he showed me the message that he had sent his wife, and all that didn't go through. And I said, well, I said, we got a helicopter up, and all of a sudden it dawns onto him, and he says, his whole face drops. He goes, am I going to have to pay for this? And I'm like, well, helicopters, $2,500 an hour, that's been up probably for 4 hours, you know, and yeah, so it was, but it was just that transition from that professor, you know, figuring out, I might have to pay for this, and it was pretty expensive. All over not having that connection. He did the right thing. Again, it was a mistake. So he didn't have to pay for that. Although I did give a nice donation for all the efforts to the search and rescue people. But yeah, so you're right. You're right. And having that forethought and doing training like you're providing, I think is essential. People got to understand that they need the training, and then someone to provide it that's got the expertise like you do.
Oh, I was just going to say, on pony on what Wayne said, those type of search and rescue scenarios that we've all dealt with, you've heard the horror stories, especially with your curriculum. I'm sure students that have either had a friend, had a relative that have been lost or stranded because, again, they didn't take Mother Nature, who is brutal. She's honest, but she's incredibly brutal, and we can never underestimate her because she's always going to win. And it's kind of if we can win with her. And we dealt with that through all three of our collective careers. But I want to go back to what you're doing now. We're going to talk about extensively, but let's go back to the roots of it all and getting to know you a little bit through mutual friends and obviously being part of Fields Craft Survival when I interviewed with Mike many years ago when you guys were actually kind of getting started. I think about the same time you were just starting to join the company. What catalyzed you to get there? We're going to talk about you being a high school academic instructor and things like that, but as a kid, we all have this story, whether it was a father, an uncle, a mentor that triggered you in and just, you know, you just got the bug, man. You felt it within your spirit. And I'm thinking about your father, getting to know a little bit about your backstory and his influence and anyone else. Take us back to the beginning and what led you in this direction, because you've always had this passion for survival, for outdoor living on every level, even when you were a teacher. And take us back to that if you can.
Absolutely. As you said, much like a lot of the listeners, there's always that one person who you can trace it back to the source. And for me, it was my father. And as a little kid, my father was, or is, I should say, he's 85 years old, and I talk to him every night. My father is one of the greatest men I've ever known. He did what he could when I was young to always encourage me to get into whatever I enjoyed. He wanted his son to be happy. And when I found out that my father lived in the jungle, I wanted to know more about the Philippines. I was like, well, Dad, what did it look like? What did you carry? What did you do? He would always sketch on yellow legal pads, like, well, this is what a Crossman air rifle looked like. And it shot a BB or it shot a pellet. And he would draw the pellet. And then he'd say, I used to, at 12 years old, carry a bolo on one side and carry a rifle on the other. And I would go and kill birds, and that's what we would eat at night. And I was like, this is incredible. And then as I got older and I started learning more, my dad would say things like, when the Japanese Imperial Army invaded, we moved into the jungle, and my brothers and his dad, so my father speaking, my dad, you know, they survived there until approximately August of 1945, evading the Japanese. And I was like, this is wild. And I don't recall the first time that the concept of survival really kind of stuck with me. But I knew at a young age that there were these people that did survival type things. And I remember watching with my dad because he knew it piqued my interest. I remember being a young kid watching First Blood, Rambo Part 2.
Yes.
And I remember watching Red Dawn. Like, I'm a child of the 80s. Like, the greatest decade to grow up if you wanted to do cool stuff in the great outdoors.
Absolutely.
So I remember watching all these movies with my dad and then being like, Dad, can we do this? Can we do that? So we went to the Barnes Nature Center. And the Barnes Nature Center in my hometown of Bristol, Connecticut, is a conservation center that's run by the Environmental Learning Centers of Connecticut. And I went hiking for the first time with my dad. And I remember walking into the woods. The first thing he taught me was pick up a stick. I'm like, pick up a stick. So I pick up this like tiny little stick. He's like, a walking stick. I'm like, well, Dad, what's it for? He goes, well, if you need to protect yourself, you can protect yourself with it. Now, people are probably going to laugh. They're going to be like, yeah, of course, Filipino, he's going to swing a stick because we do a screama and we do, you know, Kali with sticks. But my dad was like, yeah, we would always carry a stick in case you have to hit a snake. Well, we went hiking in the cold, so there were no snakes, but he was worried about dogs. And my dad took me hiking there for the first time. And then eventually it led to, let's go camping. And we went camping at White Pines Campground in Connecticut. And then I wanted to go fishing. So I went fishing with my dad and my Uncle Ray and with my cousin Bobby Ozenkowski. And like, I started learning all these things. And then eventually, you know, it became, well, Dad, you mentioned a pellet gun. So my dad was like, all right, let's get you a pellet gun. But it became like the father's secret. And my dad set up a pellet trap with like a piece of carpet inside of a cardboard box that I always shot in the basement, but never when my mom was around. So that became like father and son secret.
Hide it from mom. Yeah.
Like my dad would go, and that meant like, mom's coming, hide the gun. And I would hide it behind the drywall, you know? And my mom was like, what are you doing down here? I'm like, oh, just playing, you know? But I was really shooting my pellet gun and indoors. So like my dad and I always had that, you know, father-son bond. And eventually that led to taking the hunter safety class. And keep this in mind, like my dad came to the United States as a physician, which I know it's going to be hard to believe because, you know, there's no such thing as a Filipino medical professional. Like there's no such thing as a Filipino nurse or a Filipino doctor. But my dad came to this country, and when he became a doctor, he never wanted to take the life of another animal. So I remember as a little kid, he'd catch mice and throw them outdoors, or he'd catch spiders and throw them outdoors. And when his son was like, hey, Dad, I want to go bird hunting, my dad was like, I don't really want to do that. But he did it for me, you know, and he's like, I'll bring you up and I'll teach you how to fish and hunt and whatnot. So it was really my dad in the 80s and in the 90s who kind of fostered this love for the outdoors. And granted, like my dad also showed me how to be a gentleman, how to walk on the outside of the road when you're walking with your girlfriend or in his case, his wife, you know, my mother. He taught me how to be respectful, but I think he was hoping that I'd eventually, you know, move away from wanting to rough it. You know, he's like, you're the greatest country in the world. Like you can turn on hot water and have hot water. You don't have to boil it.
You don't have to do this, son. You don't have to do this anymore. You're like, I want to, Dad.
Yeah, and when Dad thinks it's funny, he's like, yeah, you still go out and, you know, you go where you have to do it the hard way. But when you come from his background where everything is taken from you, you grow up in a war-torn country where your home is defiled by an invading army, you don't want to rough it. You want to get back to having some semblance of normalcy and you want to get back to living a comfortable lifestyle. But he thought it was always funny, even to this day, when I'm like, Dad, I'm going to go sleep in a hammock up in the woods for a week. He's like, why would you do that? But it is what it is.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. What an incredible, incredible mentor to have. And it's cool that he's still at 85, healthy, and you get to talk to him every day. And what a blessing, brother. That is so cool. And I can only imagine how proud he is of you with what you're doing now to take this to perpetuate the message and instill that confidence in the outdoors for so many people. And I would imagine, I apologize if I'm being presumptuous with this, but because he mentored you and he was your teacher, did that inspire you to become a teacher yourself? And I'm thinking about when you became a high school teacher and what catalyzed that, and especially the subject matter you taught, if you could talk about that. Because I think right now, as we're losing a focus and an appreciation for true American history or even world history, and the narrative has changed so much, and you were doing that, and that's kind of becoming a lost art as things get watered down. So did that inspire you, and how did that go from your dad's standpoint and then to do almost 14 years as a teacher?
Yeah. So my father never pushed me to follow his footsteps into medicine. If anything, my father discouraged me from doing anything with medicine because he said that the career had changed so much from the time that he started as a doctor in 1965 in this country to when he eventually retired, which, by the way, he only retired in January of this year. Oh, so he worked for 58 years as a doctor. So he wanted me to see the job, and he wanted me to, you know, experience what he did. He never hid anything from us. But he also wanted me to do something to be a professional. He always liked the idea of me doing something where it wasn't necessarily in harm's way. And that was something that, you know, a lot of friends say, well, why didn't you join the military, or why didn't you become a cop and do this type of stuff? And it was out of respect for my father, because at a young age, he asked me, he said, will you tell me that you'll never do this? Because he saw what it was like firsthand. And I said, Dad, I love you. I won't. And it was very difficult, because in my lifetime, my senior year of college was 9/11. And I remember being a senior, and I remember about to go to the World Trade Center the following Saturday after 9/11 for a law school convention. Because up until my senior year, I was preparing to become a lawyer. And I had taken the LSATs. I was taking the prep courses. My major in college was American Studies with minor in Legal Studies and Politics. Like, I had dedicated 3 years of my life at that point to become a lawyer. 9/11 happens. Now, I'm stuck in this weird phase where I want to do something. And we didn't know what the heck to do that day. So as a bunch of college students, we went and we gave blood. We're like, that's the least we could do right now. And where I went to school, at night, you could see the smoke plumes from 9/11, because I went to Fairfield University on Long Island Sound. So we could see the smoke plumes from the towers at night. And now we're like, oh my God, you know, what's going to be the fate of the world? And I was like, I don't know if I want to interpret the law as a lawyer or if I want to enforce it. And part of me was like, do I go back on the word with my father? And I contemplated going into federal law enforcement. But then I was like, I can. I'm a man of my word. My father said that you're only as good as your word. And if you say something, you follow it up and you stick to it. And I was like, oh. But it was weighing on me. I'm like, well, what do I do? Well, the fun part is I tried doing the law enforcement standards. Now, remember, senior year, I had packed on a few pounds in college. I tried running and I was like, maybe not the best idea that I try out to be a cop right now. I said, all right, after my senior year, what am I going to do? Let's just delay. Let's kind of extend the process of making a decision for life. So I started my master's degree in American Studies. I was like, I enjoy the curriculum. I enjoy learning about American history. I enjoy writing the research papers. I've always been a writer. So I took my studies to grad school, and I went to Trinity College, and I got my master's in American Studies. But now at that time that I'm a struggling grad student, where, you know, as a grad student, you're selling your soul to write papers and to sit in the library and to look online at all these, you know, online repositories of historical documents. I was like, I need to do something to make a little bit of money. So I was like, my oldest sister was like, hey, you should become a substitute teacher. I'm substitute teaching. So I was like, all right. I became a substitute teacher. The first class I ever substitute taught was like a first grade class. And I felt like Arnold, kindergarten cop. These kids owned me. Like, they basically...
They're tearing you apart.
Like, you know, I'll tell you, like, you want to say like, oh, every teacher has a heart of gold. Every teacher, you know, I wanted to take some of these kids and throw them out the window. Like, I felt like Arnold, like, shut up. So at the end of the day, they handed me a handwritten letter. Like, every kid had drawn a picture, and they're like, oh, we love you. Thank you for being our teacher. Like, oh, these kids aren't so bad. So I did a second day, and it was at the high school. And when I was at the high school and I was subbing for a history class, I was like, I actually know this material. And the kids were like, hey, mister, do you know anything about this? And eventually it got to the point where they asked me some questions. Mm. And I was like, well, yeah, this is how I view it. And I told them how I saw it. I brought up historical concepts. I'm a big conceptual teacher. So I was like, well, I actually know this stuff. Maybe I should see if I could do this as a career. So I signed up for the exit exam to be a teacher. I didn't even take the entrance exam. I didn't do student teaching. I took the exit exam and I passed it with flying colors. I was like, maybe there's something here.
Nice.
So I I eventually started sweating bullets when I had to take the entrance exam, because the entrance exam included math. Now, I will tell you that I am the atypical Asian in that I can drive really well, and I don't know math really well. So I was
Kevin, where's your math science like PhD, man? Come on now.
I'm also half Polish, but I'm not a math guy. So I was really nervous taking that math entrance exam, but I ended up passing that. So then it was just left over to, like, I have to do student teaching, and in a roundabout way, I made my way into a student teaching program. And by the time I was done with student teaching, I submitted my application to a couple different municipalities. I got hired by two. I chose one. And the fun part of that is that I eventually ended up teaching at the high school that I attended. So now I'm teaching with teachers that I had as my own teachers, but I'm working side by side with them. And it was a great experience for 14 years.
Wow. And you were teaching primarily history that entire time, right?
Wow, that is correct. I started off with freshman world history, and I ran the gambit. I taught sophomore U.S. history. I taught the advanced placement, the college level courses, world history, human geography. I taught it all, but I really loved teaching history to those kids.
Man, that's incredible. And you made the transition out, but before we go into that, you saw a lot as far as the evolution of teaching, of styles, obviously history and other topics now with virtual learning and remote learning and homeschooling and then COVID and everything going remote and people not even in schools for the longest time. What's your thoughts on that transition and that change, having been a teacher in academics, and what are we doing right and what are we doing wrong for the next generation? Because obviously all three of us on this podcast are very fortunate and very blessed to mentor young adults in levels of conservation, survival, upcoming law enforcement jobs or whatever. And we all have taught throughout our whole careers at some level or another. And it's been a real, real blessing. I mean, pinch yourself, you know, that we get to do that. But I've also seen a lot of changes that aren't for the good necessarily of what our kids are exposed to and how it's going. And nobody, your experience in that and what you've seen is really valuable because you were in academics so long. From a professional standpoint, what are you seeing now, and what should we be looking at in the future when we look at education in general for our next generation?
A fantastic question. Fantastic question, because not enough people are talking about this.
Yeah.
I will say, before I even start off with what I'm seeing, is if you are a person listening to this podcast and you are upset with what is being taught at school, I will say, do not address the teacher, address the district. Many teachers, their hands are tied with what they can and cannot teach and how they teach and the lessons that they are required by their district to teach. And we saw this, and I'll say that so many of the teachers are great at what they do. Now, the career has been infiltrated by some folks who maybe aren't exactly the best influences for kids, but we can say the same about the medical career. We can say the same thing about law enforcement. There's going to be bad apples in every bunch. But by and large, teachers don't get into teaching to make $1 million, right? They're getting into teaching for the love of the kids. Now, what we can say now is that teaching has gotten away from many of the practical skills that kids need to have. What I used to love as a teacher was when we had an opportunity for a lesson to make kids thinkers. And for kids to actually apply critical thinking skill sets as opposed to training for a test.
Right.
Now, to understand how schools get a lot of their funding, they have to take standardized testing or state testing, where how they perform will dictate the amount of funding that they receive from the government. What this forces the teachers to do is it forces them to teach to the test as opposed to teaching to the individual. Fair. What we can say is that when kids are just learning basic information that in this day and age, all they have to do is Google something. Well, do we want to waste time teaching kids something that they can eventually Google? Or do we want to spend that time, invest that time teaching kids how to think critically when they don't have that ability to Google? The hardest questions in the world to ask Google are, why did this happen? Or how did this happen? As opposed to, what was or what is. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, school systems become vending machines of they're creating one product that looks exactly like the next year, right? One group of kids is exactly like the next year. How did they score on this test? How did they score on these sets of questions? As opposed to, let's see what these kids' interests really are, and let's foster their interest, build some creativity. Let's let these kids, you know, really come into their own. Well, we saw kids who were very, very good visual learners. They could depict something that happened historically in a drawing. Well, that drawing means nothing because that drawing is at a bubbled in letter A, B, C, D, or E. Well, unfortunately, teachers, their hands are tied. They can't teach that kid the way that that kid needs to be taught. And many kids are slipping through the cracks. Now, during COVID, these kids were being taught remotely. So not only were they not being taught where a teacher can walk around the room, scan the room, check to see how a kid is doing. Now these kids are learning to game the system where a kid could take their phone, hold it here in front of the camera, look just below the eye level, and it looks like they're looking at the screen, but they're really playing on their phone. Kids lost the respect for the teacher. And ask any teacher today how kids are post-COVID to pre-COVID, and they'll say kids don't respect the system. Luckily, there are programs like the Apogee program, which I'm going to be working with very closely. I actually have a meeting with them a week from today with Matt Boudreau, the founder, where they have a self-reliance curriculum, and they want me to do something with that nationwide. These kids are now going to get away from standardized testing and get back to learning life skills. Like if you wanted to learn how to balance a checkbook or understand a budget in traditional public school, you'd have to take a small business class. So these kids are learning reading and writing, but they're not understanding that they can run their life like a small business. But not every kid was exposed to that. So I think the general trend now is that there is a section of the population, and I mean, the Apogee program is growing. 50 schools are going to be, brick and mortar schools are being set up this fall, and another 100 to 200 will be set up next year. So it's growing at a great rate. Where parents are opting out of public ed, and they're saying, I want my kid to get this traditional education. Because when superintendents say, well, we're making kids college ready, not every kid needs to go to college. Right. Not every kid needs to get into debt, which will be equal or greater to their first mortgage payment. They might instead learn a trade where they leave trade school after 2 years, 4 years, whatever it may be, and now they are debt-free because they have they've earned that trade by being an apprentice, by being a journeyman, and they get to work with their hands, be super creative, release that energy that they can't release on a piece of paper by working with their hands. Like, I really think education now is at a pivotal moment where public ed is floundering and these private institutions, these private learning communities are really going to take off.
Yeah, I agree. I'm seeing that too. I teach at my the White Mountains Community College in Berlin, and the same type of what you're seeing, that transition. And the neat thing from where you came from and what you're doing, I think, Kevin, is you're bringing all that insight into teaching. You know how to teach. You know, me going from a game warden, especially as a lieutenant, going into being a professor was, it was a learning curve, to be honest with you. It's a different type of teaching. But when you come from that, the type of teaching you're talking about and putting it into, I don't even want to call it training. You're giving skill sets. You're letting that critical thinking, the stuff that you're talking about, is the stuff I had to learn going from to tell people what to do to now I got to instill this learning process in, and it's been a learning process for me too. But using that segue, I got to believe you were extremely valuable in what you do because of the way you do it and from your background and going into that. And maybe you can talk about that segue. A New Hampshire term.
it's funny because I start off every single class with a brief bio, and I kind of abbreviate it from what I gave, you know, you guys, where I say, guys, at some point today, you're going to feel like you're in a high school class. I'm going to talk to you like a teacher. But I understand like when I'm teaching a class, whether it's land navigation or it's a survival class or defensive shotgun, it's always about the student. And I am a stickler for the student to the point where I recently got into a big argument with the president of Fieldcraft where, you know, I took on four additional students at a course, bringing my course number up to 24. And that president was like, well, can you do 30?
Yeah.
I'm like, no, not LANAV, not half. Well, why not? Like, well, you never sat in on one of my LANAV classes. You don't understand that. It's very intricate. People don't want to feel like a number in a classroom.
Right.
30 is a massive class, even if you have two instructors, because you're now one of the numbers as opposed to a name. And right. I was like, not happening. So we capped it at 24. And even with that, I'm still going to bring in an assistant instructor of mine to just help walk the room. With that being said, I always believe that every single class should have clear objectives. And many times you attend a seminar by someone who maybe is super popular as a social media influencer or just has that persona where you're like, man, I just want to train with that person. But then you find out that they're a persona, they're not a trainer. Or you find out that you're paying for the photo at the end of the day, if you even take that photo, standing next to the cool guy. But at the end of the day, like, that photo doesn't translate to skills. It translates to bragging rights. Mm-hmm. And I'm always about, guys, I want you to leave with measurable skills. Mm-hmm. So when I say with LANAV, you will be able to verbally transfer information, positional data, direction, distance, and description of terrain. And by the end of the day, you're going to do that in a route card. Well, at the last lesson that they do is they build a route card on a map. And I go around and I look at everyone and I'm like, could you have done this today? Nope. Well, guess what? You have physical proof. Mm-hmm. You have something tangible that shows that there was knowledge that was passed along, knowledge that, you know, you will never leave home without. And as a teacher, I always make sure that it's very little me. It's like, I'm going to show you the skill set, but don't say, oh, it's really cool that Kevin can do that. I'm not doing it to brag. I'm not doing it to show, look how fast I am or how cool I am. It's mm-hmm. I'm showing you a skill, and then I'm stepping away and I'm saying, it's on you guys. Here, I'm going to walk you through it. Unfortunately, in the field that I'm in, there are many instructors that do that where they show an impossible standard and they say, well, I'm up here, you're down here, you're nothing. And it's like, if you remember that comparison is the thief of joy, you just crush that student capability. They only should measure themselves off of themselves. At the beginning of the class, where are they? At the end of the day, where are they? And my goal is to get you to a new level. And I have had some amazing feedback from students, and I'm very, very pleased with the way that I've been received. And I always tell my students, I'm like, guys, I am here to make the instruction as good as I can possibly make it. And I want you to give me feedback, good, bad, and different, because it's not just about you. It's about the next group that comes in. And maybe there's something that can help me see a way that a skill set needs to be taught to make it the best version of instruction possible. But unfortunately, some instructors are like, this is my way. I'm only going to do it this way. I don't care what you have to say about it. It's not helping. Wrong way to approach it. Teaching is a practice. It's never a perfection.
Right.
Yeah. I really, really like, Kevin, that you come from that standpoint. And I think you and I share that definitely as teachers. And I know from when you mentioned numbers in the class and being pushed to have 30 in a class that's so technical, you're going to kill the spirit. Everyone's going to feel like a number. They're going to get lost in the shuffle. And after doing a career of teaching cadet classes on firearms and defensive tactics, and then SWAT teams and snipers and big crowds, and, you know, there's five of us instructors, you lose the heart of the individual. And what has happened since I retired from operations and started teaching smaller groups, and I'll do a private one-on-one class if it can be facilitated, or up to four on, you know, whether it's handgun, wilderness medicine combination, whatever we're putting together, because I get these inquiries from people that say, men and women, young adults, whatever, hey, you know what? I just don't feel comfortable going to this class, man. I feel intimidated. I don't think I'm good. I think I'm going to get criticized. I don't think the instructors are going to really relate to me. Can you do this class, John, that kind of tailors to me? Because I feel like I can get some one-on-one connection. I can feel not intimidated, but motivated. And I'm just seeing that a ton, especially after COVID, especially after the readiness scares happened, which we're going to get into in a little bit. But I think a lot of us in the instructional world look at, hey, man, I'm going to go to this school because that brand is really cool. I want that certificate, you know, and I know what they're doing up on YouTube or up on IG and Instagram. But the quality of instruction is everything. And I know Wayne's the same way. And what we haven't really talked to another instructor doing similar things that are so about the quality of what we're giving those people and what we're getting from them and what we're adapting in real time to that student, because we're not dealing with 30 people alone, you know, especially in a perishable skill where you're doing a lot of hands-on, a lot of conceptual learning, like you said. And that's something we haven't talked about on the show. So really appreciate you bringing that up, especially for a lot of other instructors in our genre of all the survival, tactical training, hunter ed, whatever that we're talking about here. That's great, great stuff. And you guys, when you finished that instruction, you had, 14 years is a heck of a run as a teacher in any genre and made a dent. What made you take the transition to become a full-time survival instructor? And obviously, I know a little bit of your background because of our mutual connection to where you work now, but there's a lot of backstory beyond that that went well before Fieldcraft Survival. And it's quite a story if you could share it.
Absolutely. So my last year of teaching was the first year of the pandemic. I remember in February of 2020, we got word that there was something that was kind of stirring. People are getting sick. There's talk of shutting down. We're like, okay. And then what was it? 2 weeks to flatten the curve. That's what we all heard. It was like, okay, we'll take that 2 week vacation. And I mean, I look at it now and I was like, that was awesome. Like COVID was amazing. I went fishing every single morning during COVID during remote teaching, because I'd be on the river at 5:30. I'd be off the river by 7:30. I'd be back online at 8 o'clock. I'd still be smelling like fish, but guess what? I was remote. It didn't matter. COVID was very interesting because we're working with the kids. We're jiving with the kids. Things are going great. And then we go remote. And I remember the first lesson I had to teach remote was a lesson I just finished teaching. We just finished the unit on World War II and the Holocaust. And they're like, well, wow, you're going to do a remote unit on the Holocaust. And I was like, guys, we just did this. And downtown, we always say Board of Ed is downtown. Downtown was like, well, they're getting the highest level of education. And every one of the teachers I worked with was like, no, they're not. You are giving us lip service. You're giving the newspapers lip service. It's not happening. And to the credit of my fellow coworkers in the history department, every one of us was like, put us in front of our kids. We'll put on a mask. Do not take our kids away from us. Let us teach them. And they're like, nope, you can't. So I was like, all right. Around that time, I got the text message from Mike Glover, and he's like, hey, I want you to teach survival at Fieldcraft. What if I were to offer you this, 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 and this? So I had scheduled to go out to teach a class called Bug Out on Foot in Arizona. So I go out to Arizona, I teach a class with Fieldcrafter, and I was like, I really love this. And I always say that, you know, Kevin Owens, who used to work for the company, Kevin is really the reason I joined the company, because Kevin and I, we clicked. And I just enjoyed working with him. I enjoyed the energy that he brought. I loved his professionalism, the way that he managed people, and his leadership style is the best I've seen. Well, I eventually get back to teaching, but before I left Arizona, I got the COVID test where they rattled my brain with the Q-tip.
Right.
And I had my piece of paper, and I'm like, look, negative. I go back to the school, and the school was like, you're coming from an area of high transmission. You need to quarantine for 2 weeks. And I said, nonsense. I've got a negative COVID test. I want to get in my classroom and teach. They're like, quarantine. I was like, fine. You guys go. Yeah. I went home, and during the time I was quarantining, I was like, I'm planning on leaving teaching. Like, I was so frustrated with what they were doing and what they were saying was true when I knew it wasn't. I was like, I will make it to the end of this year. I'll say I taught for 15 years. I like that number. 15 works.
Yeah.
It's kind of like when you're watching television, if someone puts the volume on 14, you're like, what are you, a communist? Go to 15, right? Like, or 20, right? But never go to 14. I'm starting to teach now, and like, it's just getting crazier and crazier. I'm like, I'm done. I was like, I thought I was going to make it 15 years. I would rather join the company. So I put in my 2 weeks notice. My last day of teaching was at the end of October in 2020. And I put my townhouse up for sale. And I had moved out to Utah by January of 2021. And I look back on it now, and it's like, I talked to some friends who are still in the teaching profession, and they're like, you got out when the getting out was good. They're like, it's absolutely miserable now. And there are so many teachers who have opted out of doing 25 years or 30 years, and they're just retiring now because they don't see how they could survive with students who are running all over them and with unrealistic expectations of kids that have forgotten how to respect authority, have forgotten that there is a there's an order when they could be wherever they wanted during COVID and they could get by with minimal work. Well, suddenly when people put their feet to the fire, they can't do it anymore. And now it's the teacher's fault, where it really needs to be that whole family, the whole community involvement, where parents are saying, you know what, I need to work with my kid, as opposed to, why aren't you teaching my kid? It needs to be, how can we work together to make your kid very successful someday with whatever they decide to do? But sadly, that's not the way that things are running.
Yeah. And it sounds like you made the transition. I mean, not only was teaching just not what it was before, and obviously there were all those challenges, but now we had what we just mentioned, the COVID worldwide pandemic. Nobody knew when it started, exactly how much lockdowns were going to be. And a funny little story, ironically, 2 weeks before lockdowns, I was in Arizona on the podcast with Mike for the first time and just getting ready to go down to the southern border in West Texas and film the Thin Green Line pilot film, where we were looking at border control, hunting out at rams, watching, you know, cartel traffickers come through the ranch while we were hunting this pristine ranch, having this great conversation with Mike at Glover at Fieldcraft Survival for the first time. And then the world changed 2 weeks after we got back. And when it did, nobody really knew what to expect, right? I remember I was based in California and I loaded everything up and said, hey man, this might be the end. Who knows what this is going to lead to from a readiness standpoint, and pretty much moved back and took everything to Montana, prepared never to leave if it got to be that bad and get to that rural community where I think we were the most suited to survive and thrive through whatever was going to happen. But then the need for exactly what you teach, exactly what Fieldcraft Survival is about. I know Wayne and I had just started to become co-hosts on his podcast with Warden's Watch. We started the podcast we're on today, Thin Green Line, because of these issues and getting, talking about the pandemic, chronic wasting disease, talking about what can we do remotely to get out of lockdowns, to get the depression, to get fresh air, to get the spirit of the wild back in, you know, as a healer, and all those things were happening. And exponentially, it's been necessary now. So you made the cross at a fantastic time, and now you're doing what you love anyway, and you have a lot of knowledge base. How has it developed since then? And it definitely hasn't slowed down. And now you're the lead doing survival specifically, but Fieldcraft Survival as a whole is very comprehensive and a great program. And talk about that and where we're going with what we've learned from the last pandemic, and knowing that should we experience something similar or, heaven forbid, worse, what can we do to be prepared? And the difference between, prepping with that negative connotation we get from the old preppers and the old survivalists, right? Versus readiness, which is very critical to define the difference of, because we can get criticized in a bad misnomer when we look at it the other way.
Yeah, I think one of the things we can start with is that idea that you just finished with, the difference between preparedness and readiness. Now, part of my background, I'm a Filipino martial arts instructor, and we teach the readiness formula in Sayak Kali. Now, the readiness formula is equal parts awareness, preparedness, and willingness. So awareness is situational awareness, keeping your head on a swivel. It's using all of your senses. As game wardens, you guys know that sometimes, you see things, sometimes you smell things, sometimes you feel things, like the way that the wind changes can dictate a lot in the field. So that's awareness. Preparedness is the gear that you carry. It's also the skill set that you have. So whether you're loaded out with those 308 battle rifles that you mentioned in your book, John, or you just have your sidearm, right? Preparedness is the gear that you have, but it's also like, okay, do you know the difference between, holding your crosshairs on target or using Kentucky windage, holdovers, and so, well, that's all preparedness. But then there's willingness, and willingness is commitment to a cause. Like, what are you willing to do? What are you going to say, yes, I will do that, versus no, I won't? And I always say willingness, great way to describe it is, how willing are you to lose 5 pounds on January 1st versus how willing are you to lose 5 pounds on June 1st? Most people will peak and then they die down. Well, If you want to say that you are ready, you have to have awareness, preparedness, and willingness, because there are people out there who are aware and prepared, but they're not willing. And a perfect example of that is Uvalde, Texas. And there's a group of people out there that are prepared and they are willing, but they're not aware. And that's anyone who decides that they want to go out and drink in excess where they don't even know where they are and they have to be carried out of a bar. You could be a black belt. You could be the world's greatest tier one, you know, underwater Navy SEAL, you know, basket weaver, spec ops, Delta Force operator, you know, slash, you know, babysitter. Like, you could be whatever. It doesn't matter if you're polluted. If you get that drunk, you're not aware. And then there are the folks like Flight 93 who were aware that something was happening and they were willing to do something, but they needed to prepare themselves. So they wrapped their arms with towels. They got hot mugs of coffee that they were going to throw at the terrorists. And in that moment that they were aware, prepared, and willing, they were ready. And what did they say? Let's roll. Right?
Yep.
So I think if you look at people who only buy gear, and they become that prepper where it's like, well, last time I couldn't get toilet paper, so I have 10,000 rolls of toilet paper. It's like, well, do you happen to have anything that could charge batteries? Well, no, I'm not. Guess what? You're just a prepper, right? You're not even aware that you need that item to help you charge your batteries if there's a power outage. Then there are people out there who are, you know, very willing, like, I'm going to do this. It's like, slow your roll, right? Like, there's only so much with an individual. Right. Like, people out there say, like, oh, I've got my bug out bag. I've got my giant battle rifle that I'm going to run through the streets with to get to my bug out location. It's like, if on 9/11, you decided to walk down the road with a AR-15 and a chest rig with 12 mags, you're going to get a. Yeah. Like, you don't fit into the norm. So it's like, listen, I'm not telling you not to have that. I have my AR-15 in the car right now. Anytime I go on the road, a rifle goes with me because the further you go from home, the bigger your firearm should be. Well, yeah. I get that. But there are people out there that don't understand that there's a balance. And that, yes, you have all the gear. Maybe you have all the willingness. But what else can you learn? COVID was a great opportunity for people to learn because you were stuck at home. You could YouTube your university, everything. During COVID, that's when I really picked up my appreciation and my love for game butchering. Because during COVID, one of my hunting buddies is a retired state trooper who now works auxiliary. And he would call me anytime that there was a deer that was killed. He'd be like, hey, you want to go pick up a deer? I'll give you a claims ticket. So I'd go pick it up and I would butcher this deer, you know. And it was funny. The best part was that where I was doing it was in the northwest corner of Connecticut, where a lot of people from New York City escaped the craziness of New York. And they're like, oh, we're going to be up in the country of Connecticut. Well, here I show up. I've got my, you know, dirty car hearts on, and I'm throwing a dead deer that was killed on the side of the road in the back of a pickup truck. And I give the redneck thumbs up to people passing by, like, yeah, you know, and they'd be savage. But COVID was an opportunity to learn. And why are we waiting for the next pandemic to learn? Why aren't we going into courses like the ones that we teach at Buildcraft, the ones that my friends in the survival community, Nature Reliance School, teaches tracking? Why aren't we learning the rope skills that SE Knives is teaching, or primitive skills that Maine Primitive Skills School or Jack Mountain Bushcraft is teaching? Like, you don't have to wait for the emergency to suddenly become a student. You should be a student every single day. And to your question of, like, how have things changed since I've started at Fieldcraft, I developed a lot of classes for the company. Our one-day survival classes, wilderness survival skills, where with just a handful of items, like even this knife, right? If someone says, well, I carry a Swiss Army knife, but I don't carry a backup knife. Well, guess what? We're going to change your mindset because one is none, two is one, right? Yes. We're going to teach you there's a pace planning, primary, alternate, contingency, and emergency, right? You might have your Swiss Army knife. You might have your folding knife. You might have an axe. You might have a folding saw. And guess what? All of them serve different purposes, but you might not be thinking that way because you might say, well, I have a knife. You have one knife. That's great until you have no knife, right?
Right.
But then from that one-day course, we do a two-day where we take you a little bit deeper into the woods. We give you 20 hours of instruction, and we're like, let's look at the bushcraft concept now. Let's look at these traditional living skills. Let's look at the way people lived on the frontier and skill sets that are falling by the wayside, because people want to embrace technology when we have skills that I don't need a mechanical ascender for a rope if I know right.
Right.
I don't need a belay device if I understand a munter pitch. This is why I joined Fieldcraft, because I love the concept of Fieldcraft. I love the idea of teaching people, if you are in the field for an extended period of time, how do you get by with minimal gear? That to me is Fieldcraft. We developed the hunter prep course that Jerry Young and I taught for the first time in September or October of 2021, where we're like, here are basic lassing skills. Here's a Kim's game. Here's how you do the basic med in case you fall on a broadhead. Here's how you do, chronograph your rifle, and you can understand with a true muzzle velocity what your bullet will do at different ranges and different density altitudes. So like, we try and cross it over with the various skill sets to make hunters more capable outdoors. And I think that's really the direction that America needs to go, is how do you ask yourself and how do you make yourself more capable every single day? Because you have an opportunity from one day to the next to become more capable. Sadly, people forget that opportunity, or they don't take up that opportunity. And it's just a wasted chance to do something that makes you an asset to your community, to your family, instead of a liability.
Yeah, 100% agreed, Kevin. And I like when you say, essentially, when it comes to gear, it's not only the gear, but it's actual proficiency with the gear, and less is more, less is more, less is more. And coming from a tactical background where we always say, hey, man, if it says SWAT and has Velcro, I got to have three of them. You know, I mean, I can't tell you in all the years of with SWAT teams and training them, competing with them. I mean, everyone's a gear junkie. And then you have so much crap. And every time you kit up for a different operation or a different hunt, let's say, and the same thing transcends into hunters now that are buying, you know, the $10,000 buy once, cry once, and the Kestrel ballistic computer, and they're getting this optic, and, you know, and they're not training with it. You know, they're getting just a plethora of gear, and then it's just a stress factor when they got to go deploy it for either a hunt, or worse yet, if it does become a survival situation where you're actually trying to go field to table because the grid is truly down and now you're just surviving with your family or your community. And I think that's what we forget. We forget that we can prep, buy, have all this great equipment, and now we're left with this yard sale and, oh no, what now? And what happens when, you know, something really bad does happen? And you guys are just doing it completely the right way over at Fieldcraft, is tracking, you know, water sources, everything about stocking, and the hunter prep courses, starting to see that develop on your end is kudos. We don't see enough of that. And I know something Wayne and I noticed through COVID, and we always try to play to the positives through any poor situation, I know you do too, was the sudden love. And you and I talked about this on your show recently, and it was a passionate kind of spinoff. I wasn't, didn't think we'd go there, and I'm glad we did. Thank you for that. But how much nature became a healer through the pandemic, and how many more people got into the outdoors. And not only did they get into the outdoors, but now we had non-hunters that didn't think killing animals was anything but savage and horrible. And now they're like, uh-oh. Hey man, I'm watching the news. I'm seeing, you know, the Walking Dead zombie apocalypse attack pallets of freaking toilet paper, and they're taking the last piece of flank steak and fighting for it or whatever. So I may have to hunt now. I may have to actually provide for my family. So I do need to get a rifle, which I've never shot. I don't know how to harvest an animal humanely. And what do I do about field dressing the darn thing? And we had, what was it, Wayne, 35-40% increase in the number of people signing up for online hunter education courses online, and then running up to buy a weapon and not having any infrastructure in there to get the training. And I'm getting weird calls for training. I'm sure you guys must have been swamped at the Fieldcraft survival time as you were starting up. But that was a very positive thing. And I think it kind of unified different demographics of preservationists versus conservationists, left, right. Now we all became humans, and we all became somewhat communal, if we could, in the right communities, to go ahead and prepare for surviving as a community and not just eroding. And you guys keep pushing that. What are your thoughts there? And if anything, what have we learned out of COVID as a shot across the bow? Because it could have been much worse had it been an anthrax or Ebola or some other crazy Wuhan lab concoction that could have killed 80% of us, let's say. What do we learn from that for the future? And what do we need to do more of moving forward, in your opinion, from this training for everybody throughout the nation and really throughout the globe?
Yeah, so it was interesting during COVID. It wasn't just the hunting and the fishing for people getting into the great outdoors. And I loved it in Connecticut because the governor, he actually said, hey, fishing season's open right now. And I was like, it's open right now? I went out the day that I found out and I was like, I'm fishing. And I, to this day, some of the greatest fish I've ever come with during COVID because I lived 10 minutes away from a trophy trout river. But you saw people during COVID who they were buying mountain bikes. You saw people during COVID, they were buying kayaks. You know, whether it was Craigslist or Facebook Marketplace or whatever, it used to be swamped with people trying to get rid of old gear. Like they'd go to the big box store and they'd buy the entry-level recreational kayak before they realized, hey, I want like a whitewater kayak or a sea kayak. Well, during COVID, people swallowed up everything that was on the marketplace just to get out. Like, it got to the point where boats that people couldn't give away, they actually were selling for two or three times the value when people were like, wait a minute, that boat sold for $600 when it normally sells for $300 and it was scratched up and there might be a ding in it. Like, it was amazing. But now here's another thing. People also didn't learn the etiquette of where they could or could not take their boats or where they could leave them. And we also have to remember that during this time, it was that springtime when the rivers swelled. So what happened was, people were buying these kayaks, leaving them on riverbanks. They would get picked up during the floodwater, brought out to Long Island Sound. And now the Coast Guard and all the environmental cops were like, there's a boat that doesn't have a paddler floating, missing person. Like, we need to do like a grid search. Like, and they were going on the news saying, hey, if you have your boat, please put your name in it. Please tie up your boat so we don't, you know, expend resources. I think if anything, what we can learn from COVID in terms of love of the outdoors, what we can learn from COVID is that it happened once, it will happen again.
Yes, thank you.
It's time now to secure the capabilities, secure the tools that you need to get your family outdoors, to become more self-reliant. Like you said, people were fighting over pallets of toilet paper. And it got to the point where I would go to the store and I'd carry not only my pistol, but I'd have two or three spare mags instead of just one spare mag.
Yeah.
So it felt like there was an urgency of Red Dawn. Like, come on in here, boys, get some more clothes and food. Like, it felt like you had to get what you could get. But during COVID, we realized people were looking for store-bought meat until they realized that there was wild meat available. People were saying, well, there's no food at the grocery store. But yet in the baking aisle, there was so much, you know, baking goods, you could make bread during COVID and still have nutrition. I think we need to realize, like, what did people overlook and how can we address what they overlook now? So when the next time it happens, you're not in that panic mode. You can say, I'm going to let the crowds do what the crowds do. We're good. And if anything, tighten up your community. During COVID, I learned to, have a handful of people who I could rely on and say, hey, Dave, I'm coming over. I'm going to grab that deer. Hey, I'm coming. Like, you have that tight-knit group and you just check in every so often, check in on your buddies and you're like, hey, you good? Do you need anything? Because it's impossible for one person to have it all. I mean, we're not all multi-millionaire, super, super wealthy, financially independent, but as a community, we're strong. And as a former coach, as someone who, and granted, I coached an individual sport. I coached track and field. But from someone who does a lot of corporate training and leadership development, right? Take any one finger and jam it up against the wall and you're going to break that finger. But you bring those five fingers together into a fist and now you're strong. If anything, we can take that lesson from COVID where we could say, what were we good at individually and what did we excel as a community? We need to embrace that community. Even though now the restrictions have been lifted and we might want to go do things solo, now is the time to bring people into your interest because your tribe doesn't have to be a tribe of one. It can be a tribe of people who are all hunters, fishermen, who all know how to navigate, who all know how to defend, because that tribe is going to be so much stronger than any one person acting on the road.
Yeah, I think you hit it spot on, man. And that's the field craft survival ethos really as a whole. You know, when I met you guys way back in the day with Mike, and it's something I think we did learn. And I think we got very lucky in COVID because
it wasn't as severe as it could have been, but it was a great test, right? And it gave us some time. And I think now when it comes to readiness and preparedness, it's our own fault if we didn't learn from that and we didn't tighten up our community, we didn't tighten up our supplies and our capabilities. And today now, it was for something that was so alienating and so scary for so many people, especially in the heavy populated urban areas where we saw what was happening in the Costcos. We saw what was happening in New York City. I saw what was happening in the Silicon Valley in Los Angeles when I happened to be working in California at the time. And man, it was freaky. It was seriously a Red Dawn meets Walking Dead scenario. And, you know, if I wasn't behind locked gates here where I did my career as a game warden, I didn't want to be anywhere near the city till I could just get back home to Montana. But those smaller communities, especially, you know, towns of 10,000, 20,000, 3,000, we came together, man, and it was beautiful. I remember in Montana, in our little town, Wednesday nights, everybody, the supervisors, the community boards, the police, the fire department put together what they called Up the Gut. And everybody would get on their motorcycles, their side-by-sides, or their trucks and their cars. And we would drive one avenue that was kind of our main downtown street run by the one screen theater, the whole nine, and the businesses, and just drive where we stayed a little bit separated because nobody really knew how bad this thing was. But the community got together for an hour from 7 to 8 p.m. and just drove, waved, had patriotic flags, and we realized we were not alone. And then we all stuck with our families and made sure we had the gear we needed. And heaven forbid we had to start going taking animals out of season, right? It, you know, hear no, see no, do no, Wayne, as game wardens, but that's what it was going to come down to. So I think you hit that on the head. And I know moving forward, you guys offer a lot of curriculum, mindset stuff, yourself included and your other instructors for our listeners. Can't speak highly enough of what Fieldcraft Survival offers and everything you're about, Kevin. And thank you for what you provide more than anything else. Thank you for what you provide with the passion of instruction, the curriculum, and bringing people together. And with so much divisiveness, political unrest, and everything we saw through pandemics and the geopolitical climate of what we're facing in the world right now, we're finding a way to unify. And something Wayne and I have always been about, what you and I talked about with the Hidden War contingent, how it's a unifying fight as a nation. And you're part of that, man, and a big part of the Thin Green Line and a part of that effort. And we are super, super grateful. Before we wrap up and talk about where we can find you and all the class opportunities and things like that, I know we talked a little bit about some hunts and a little bit about a hunt you have coming up with a potential black bear thing, and I shared some stuff with you. I knew you were an angler. I knew you did some hunting before we met. I didn't know how crazy passionate you were about it. And I got to ask you, and I know you have many, many hunting stories that just stand out as those iconic top 10, you know, peripherals. Give us a hunting or fishing story that just really stands out. And maybe one that went perfectly smooth or one that didn't go so great. The boat tipped over. Maybe you saw a grizzly. Maybe you were run off the river fly fishing. You got to have something out there, man, that just stands out given the places you've explored. Please share one.
So probably my favorite hunting story to date is one that I've never shared the photos or the videos of, but I will tell you
that already tells me it's going to be a fantastic story. Here we go.
This is one of those hunts that if I shared the photo or the video of what happened, I would absolutely be canceled. I would be, you know, persona non grata, like among PETA, which I'm okay with that. But at the same time, it's so wild. So back in 2018, I was part of a management hunt out in South Africa. I went with Rustfield Safaris, and what we were doing is we did a plains game hunt where we were charged with taking out a certain number, culling animals from the field for various concessions based all on scientific management, and we would donate the meat to the Amasongo Career School. And it was amazing going from the field to actually putting the meat ourselves into the refrigerators at the Amasongo Career School. Well, one of the hunts that we did while over in Africa, it was with a company called Rustfield Safaris. We did a warthog hunt. And to this day, warthog hunting might be my favorite type of hunting because
it's unpredictable.
And what happened on this first day of this warthog hunt will always be burned into my mind. So I was told I'm going to get a chance to shoot the first warthog that they see. Well, we are walking over this amazing, amazing ridgeline. And we drop into just off of the ridgeline. We're looking through a valley. So there's a nice draw. And there's another ridgeline on the far side. So the guides with their eagle vision, which I still don't know how they do this without binoculars. The guys are like, there. I'm like, I don't know what the hell you're looking at. And they're like, pull up your rifle scope. You're going to see two warthog on the other side of this valley. So I'm shooting across a gap. The first warthog was at 240 yards. The second was at about 280. And I pull up my rifle. I take good shots. The first warthog, I hit it and it dropped like a cartoon, right? Like a shooting alley. Just,
yeah.
Second one I hit and it ran a little bit and then it fell behind a bush. Well, we go to retrieve the warthogs and now we're like climbing over a fence and the guides are like, oh, look, here's the first one. I'm like, that's not the first one. I'm pretty sure that's a set. And before I could even say, I'm pretty sure that's the second one, I hear, yarp, yarp, yarp. And the hunting dog had ripped the testicles off of the first warthog. Okay. And now the warthog is filled with piss and vinegar. And it is angry and it is running away as the hunting dog is like nipping at its heels. So now I'm like, that warthog's still alive. I'm running with my rifle and I see the hunting dog on one side. I see the warthog on the other side. I see all of my friends with their cameras out recording this. And now I've got my 300 Win Mag rifle. And I'm like, if I shoot, it's going to hit. It's going to, at this range, it's going through the hog. It's going to kill the dog or it's going to kill my friends. I can't shoot. So I had a short sword with me my friend from Atienza Kali made me.
Got the katana out.
I break out the bolo, right? I'm Filipino. I break out a bolo, and now the warthog, like it's thrashing its head back and forth. It wants to kill the dog, and I just take the sword out and I thrust it through the heart and I ride it to the ground. And I'll never forget the professional guides, the skinners, the trackers, right? The bushmen. They look over at the professional hunter and they look at his friends and they go, oh, he's crazy. They had seen people kill warthogs with spears.
Yeah.
And they've done the thing with dogs, grab the legs, got knives. But like that thing wasn't being held back. I just took a sword out and I thrusted it. And now I have a photo. If anyone's really that interested, you can look back years ago on my Instagram and you can see the photo of me with my rifle and I have a sword. And if you look on the sword, there's pig blood on it, you know, almost to the hill. And this today is probably the craziest hunt I've ever been on because again, like I wasn't planning on thrusting that pig. And what had happened was I shot it low on the rib. So I clipped the lung, but I didn't get like the mass of the lung. And that thing was dying, but not dying fast enough. And when the dog found it, the dog was in the habit of ripping the ring because it pulls that mucus plug out of all the animals. It was ready to do that to the warthog. The warthog was still alive. Like, no, those are my balls. And it took the dog on a run, and I had to eventually put it down. But I have a love for Africa. I would love to go back there at some point. And even though that hunting story was absolutely crazy, like. And it was probably a once-in-a-lifetime experience. What I will impress upon the listeners is you don't have to go to Africa to have a memorable experience. I go have fun with a 22 and a bunch of squirrels, you know? Yeah. And it's just the idea of getting out there and putting, you know, field to table or river to table or ocean to table. Like you can have fun in your backyard. It just, the important thing is get outside the house. Get outside the house and share what you're learning with people who want to learn, and you'll have the most memorable experience ever.
Yeah, that's an incredible story, man. And it gets down to hunting is not an exact science. And I can say for being a fellow, you know, Russian razor hog hunter my whole life here in California, and having harvested one warthog on my first trip to South Africa, they're just magical, man. And what people don't realize, hogs, especially boar species across the globe, are tough. They are tough. They suck up a ton of energy and bullets through the gristle plate. They die really slow, even with the biggest calibers. And you get into that stuff where you may have to take them with something other than your rifle. And we've had a lot of hog and dog spear poaching things we've done here in California. But that's been, for me as well, my most dangerous encounter was getting charged by a wild boar that was bleeding out from being lung shot. And 14 rounds from my Glock 22 40 cal as he was charging me. and dying 5 feet from my legs. No kidding. This was something we actually did for a profile Glock commercial, that this gun saved my life from a four-legged animal, not just a two-legged. I had never seen animals so tough. So elk hunters and dangerous game hunters, brothers, they talk about this. So I'm going to prepare for this and I'm going to go on a brown bear hunt. I go, you know what? Shoot some hogs, you know, test your bullets, man, especially on a big ornery boar. And those warthogs are just awesome. But to your point, Africa is magical. We always say, when I've been there twice, I know you're trying to get back, I'm trying to get back, Wayne, you got to go. Because when you go once, they say it's not, you know, if you'll go back, it's kind of a drug. It's when you're going to go back. But we also have so much untampered national forests and wilderness areas all over this great country, man. And
right.
I didn't even get into my Cabinet Mountain wilderness area, which is one of the least used wilderness areas on the globe in the U.S. until COVID. Kevin, I was doing the same thing you were, other than doing this type of stuff remotely, every day it was either fishing or doing outdoor training or honing on, you know, some of those shooting skills we had time to spend a little more time on. But I was stir crazy. And as soon as the weather turned, it was up into those mountains alone and going into golden trout lakes and cutthroat trout lakes I had never been to. And to your point, it was absolutely empowering. It was invigorating. And, you know, there was a lot more hope there. And I know we talked about, Wayne, you and I got into this a lot, the suicide rate, the depression, the alcohol abuse, all of that stuff that was going on. And Kevin, you said it best, just get outside, get outside, get outside, walk a paved trail, look at a waterway, take a breath. And it just means the world. So appreciate all you're doing, man. And you're definitely an integral part of this Thin Green Line and a great teammate to have on it. And we appreciate that.
Yeah, I really appreciate you, Kevin, creating a path for people to the outdoors. And that's, to me, what you're doing. You're educating them to give them the skill sets to go out there and enjoy it. And certainly appreciate you doing that. And thanks for joining us.
And before we go, please tell us, how can people find you on socials? How can they find you at Fieldcraft Survival to book a class? Any of the bio stuff, you got to get out there so we can drive people your way.
Sure thing. So if you want to message me through my Fieldcraft Survival email, it's Estella, E-S-T-E-L-A, at fieldcraftsurvival.com. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on Twitter, at Estella Wild Ed. That's short for my old company, Estella Wilderness Education. If you guys are interested in donating to my permanent endowment fund that sends kids to summer camp programs at the Environmental Learning Center of Connecticut, that's the Estella Wilderness Education Fund at the Main Street Community Foundation. You can go to their website, which is MSCF, Main Street Community Foundation, MSCF.org, and you can search Estella Wilderness Education Fund. And I will tell you that 97% of every donation goes to the fund. Only 3% is used for bookkeeping at the end of the year. So basically, when they have to file taxes and whatnot. But that endowment fund is not a one-time deal. Basically, a donation is made to the Environmental Learning Center off principle. So it's going to be around for 100, 200, 300 years. You're
awesome.
Melted down with that. And if you guys just want to reach out to me, any of those socials is fine. I'm always happy to respond. And hopefully we'll see you guys around the fire. You know, there's lots of exciting stuff that's coming out. And if you guys want to read my book, it's 101 Skills You Need to Survive in the Woods. You can find it on Amazon. You can find it at Barnes & Noble, Books A Million. You can also just search my last name, Estella, and author. Or writer, and you'll see a whole bunch of magazine articles that I put up free over, you know, well over the past decade.
Awesome. Hey, one last thing on your book. There's going to be a sequel. I read that you're developing a second book with a bunch of more content that didn't make the first book, and super excited to hear real quick about that before we go.
Yeah, so I'm just wrapping up some of the photos for that one. I need to take some photos on my newing. But that book is going to have skill sets like basic positional rifle shooting, gear repair, winter camping, cooking in the field, basic driving in the great outdoors. Like, I'm not going to do rock crawling, but, you know, people should know, like, keep your thumbs, yeah, you know, outside of the steering wheel as you're driving over rocky terrain. All practical knowledge, and every chapter ends with dozens of tips. So that book, I'm still wrapping up the photos, but it's been written since October 2021. It's going to be published at some point.
Exciting. Well, we will look for it. I can't wait to get a copy and dive in and we'll promote it. But thanks again so much for being on the show today, brother. It has been a real pleasure, a real honor, and we look forward to connecting again down the road.
Thanks, Kevin.
Likewise. Thank you for having me.